Dumelamba haitsu. Molweni. Absheni. Sanbonani. Nina besilo. Nemadegwani. Goeiemiddag. Ladies and gentlemen. A very good afternoon. It's a great pleasure to be here with you today. And I'd like to thank you, Alec, and your team for the kind invitation. Well, when I got the invitation from me, I said, I'm not going to miss it because I knew very soon you're going to write an article about me, like the one you wrote about David. I'm like, no, I better go and show up. My name is Simon Baloyi. I'm the president and CEO of Sasol. So my BNC number is 1,159. But I'm going to hold on to this because I heard you yesterday say in 10 years' time, I can sell it for a higher price. So I'm going to hold on to it. And thank you for the invite. I've been in this role, as Alec has said, for more than a year. It was April the 1st, so it does feel like, I mean, April Fool's Day, but I started on the 2nd just to make sure that it was real. During my 20-minute talk, I'll broadly cover the following 5 key topics. I'll chat about the Sasol people, our beginnings, and a brief history of Sasol. I will talk about corporate resilience, our strategic response to the challenges that we find ourselves, right now. And I'll conclude, during my conclusion, I'll touch on the energy transition, for Sasol and South Africa, and the pragmatic approach that is required. Let me say, as I begin, that when I accepted this role, avid runner, I fully understood that tackling the challenges that Sasol is facing will be like running a marathon. To participate in a marathon, you're required to set a realistic goal. You need to be consistent, have lots and lots of focus, and be disciplined. So everywhere I go, even when I came last night, to Hermanas, I made sure I packed my running shoes because this morning I had to do my 8 to 10 Ks. There's a consistency that's required. Otherwise, you're never going to get ready. So you have to be disciplined and stick to that discipline. So regardless of the circumstances, both internally and externally, that Sasol is facing, this characteristic will continue to define how we approach and handle those challenges and opportunities ahead of us. Sasol is one of South Africa's most storied organizations. Later this year, we're going to celebrate our 75th birthday. Our history is deeply intertwined with this country's history. Alec, thank you for the kind introduction. I'm a product of Sasol. I'm a Sasol buzzer, and I've been blessed to have been given many opportunities over the last 2 decades that has shaped my career and to the person that I am today. Growing and nurturing our own talent has been the core of Sasol's strength as one of the world's most leading synthetic fuels and chemicals companies. We have expanded across geographies and to provide energy and chemical solutions around the world using homegrown technologies. Our technical capabilities are grounded in our engineering expertise and the bold Sasol can-do attitude. Yeah, sometimes this attitude does get you in trouble if you get the strategy wrong. Nothing is impossible for the Sasol team. We have designed, built, and continue to operate some of the most complex facilities and operations in the industry globally. Sasol's business capabilities has been honed through sharp commercial acumen to grow businesses that meet our customers' needs and has a fundamental impact on the communities within we operate. Sasol people are deeply committed to what they do, regardless of their station. I started in Secunda. I still remember that day, 16 January 2002. So I spent my early years, in operation, working with our frontline people in various Sasol sites. This experience has allowed me to know what drives our people, their hopes, their commitment, dedication, the love for our company, and the country in general. This is what drives me as an individual to make sure that Sasol is the best place to work. And this culture that I'm creating in the company will allow our people to continue to innovate in meeting our customers' needs and enhancing shareholder value. I grew up in Hammanskraal, so this looks much nicer. It's flat. If you've been to the north of Pretoria, Hammanskraal, I grew up there in a rural area We had no running water, no electricity. I was actually finally connected to the electricity grid in 1994 in November. I remember the day because it's the day that I finished my matric exam. And I could never believe how your mess book looks at night because I'm used to studying, used with a candle. So that's how I grew up. I walked to school, my primary school. No, thank you. My primary school, middle school, and high school were 10 kilometers from my house. So I actually walked 10 kilometers from 7 years old, until I finished school. So, it appears to be an incredible feat until you realize that we had a community. Even though you don't have the basic amenities, if you have a community and the strength of a community, it does make you strong. So, with a community, you can imagine if you are young, 7 year old walking 10 kilometers, you won't do it unless the older kids are looking after you. That's what has happened to me. And as I grow old, it was again my turn to look after the younger kids. And that spirit is a spirit which is similar at Sasol. So I'm determined to always make a difference. For me, that's what's important. Make a difference, whatever role you play. It is not about a role. It's about making sure that your life matters. And that's something that I'm determined to do. And I continue to impress that spirit upon Sasol. At Sasol, we have an expression that our blood is blue, or as they often say in Sasol, because Sasol, it's also, a deeply Afrikaans company. Ons bloed is blue. That's what the Sasol people say. So I was glad to see, I met Hank and his wife Aaron here and our former Sasol colleagues. So it's good to see the blue blast. And they reminded me, once a Sasolite, always a Sasolite. So we have that saying that our blood is blue. It's not an official line, but that's how the people express their bond with Sasol, which is a deep and emotional bond with the company. During my recent visit to Germany, I was reminded once again that all our operations around the world will be nothing. It will be stagnant equipment structured without our people. Our people are a reflection of where we come from, how we have grown, and the course we are navigating to a sustainable future. As I'm sure you're all aware, our genesis is in Sasolburg. The town itself is named after Sasol. Our company was started there in 1950, and in 1955, we actually produced the first drop of oil from coal, which in itself could have been seen as an impossible feat. And Sasolburg is where our spirit of innovation, as well as our willingness to meet the needs of our customers and the country through technology, was born. Sasolburg was the platform for our development and remains one of the flagship operations in our global portfolio of assets. Our R&D is also still housed there, where we had the largest concentration of master's and PhD students in the Southern Hemisphere and professionals. Our impressive portfolio, collectively has shaped our foundation and ensures we continue to deliver enduring value to all our stakeholders. This innovation legacy has been defined by our deep expertise in synthetic fuels and chemicals technology. This technology is known as the Fischer-Tropsch, or simply the FT. So yesterday when I came in, I met Rob Hessoff. So Rob Hessoff, his grandfather, and Rick Minnell, that you all know. Also, those two grandfathers, they actually bought the technology, from Germany, and then they later sold the technology to the government, and then the government started Sasol and commercialized the technology. So we're always grateful and thankful to the Hessoff and the Minnell family for bringing the technology to the country. This technology, it does enable us to convert carbon. It doesn't matter what is the form of carbon. It can be coal. It can be natural gas. It could be biomass. You can convert carbon. It can even be industrial CO2. You can convert that carbon and hydrogen to produce energy and chemicals products for various uses and applications. Over the decades, and notably in recent years, we have learned to flex an important capability: resilience. Corporate resilience is not just about surviving. It's about pushing to thrive in the face of adversity, adapting to unforeseen challenges, and evolving to meet the ever-changing needs of our global customers. For me, how I grew up, resilience has been built into me. So when I face, and I mean as a leader, in the time and the challenges that we face at Sasol, I face that challenges head-on. Our foundation was fortified in our early years, and it's been essential in defining the organization we have today. This foundation provided us with the capability to adapt, progress, and evolve over the decades. It has equipped us with the capability to withstand significant shifts and the events that have happened in South Africa and globally. For example, the global financial recession of 2008. At Sasol, we made it through that. In 2020, the COVID pandemic. You can imagine during COVID, you can't sell, I mean, the basic products that you make. And the oil price actually turned negative. And again, as a company, and our share price went down to $20, because to everyone else, it could have appeared like the end. But the Sasol, we made it through that. We've also faced and overcame internal challenges. I mean, just to mention a few examples, starting up the Fischer-Tropsch technology in Sasolbeck, Secunda, or Qatar, it was not an easy feat because all of them were world first. Every time we started it in Sasolbeck, we started with what's called a circulating fuel dust bed reactor, world first, and we started it up. In Secunda, we went from the circulating to a normal fuel dust reactor, and we also made it through that. Then in Qatar, we also went to a world first, which was a slurry reactor, and we also made it. So all of this has teething challenges, and Sasol overcame that. We also faced the Lake Charles, I mean, project overruns. Alec referred to that. Lots and lots of money invested in that project. And yeah, I mean, that's still a big overhang on our balance sheet, and we're busy repairing that. And most recently, the feedstock quality challenges in the Secunda region. In effect, these challenges have tested and strengthened our resilience and resolve to pursue a promising future. Sasol will and will always play an integral role in the industries that we are part of. Through our operations and extensive value chains in South Africa and globally, we have become one of South Africa's largest private taxpayers in terms of our significant employment opportunities. We have commissioned an economic study that shows that 500,000 jobs are linked to Sasol. Through direct and indirect efforts, we contribute 5% to the GDP and 12% to the national tax base. So we're a significant cornerstone organization. We are also one of the largest social investors in the country, with nearly 3 billion rands invested in various socio-economic activities over the past 5 years. The communities in which we operate are inseparably linked to our business. South Africa is a coal-based economy and is faced with one of the largest transitions in the history of the country. Sasol is playing a role and will continue to play a significant role in this transition. For example, we are the largest private procurer of renewable green electrons, with 750 megawatts procured and with more to come. In steering the Sasol ship through the stormy seas, I have to take into account multiple stakeholders that directly and indirectly impact our business. Of course, we must and we will meet the expectation of the shareholder returns, but we'll also consider the commitments and expectation of others too. Our customers are critical to our business because without our customers, we have no business at all. The global operating environment has been turbulent in the past few years, and I mean, right now it has become more turbulent. Governments are changing their priorities. They are looking more inward, impacting how people move around and how economies are structured. I'm pleased to say that in South Africa, despite the challenges that we face, I mean, you heard what Gaten has said, Councillor Pappas, I mean, I listened to him. I arrived when he was doing his address. You've heard also his comments. And Adrian Goh this morning, you heard his comments. So despite all these challenges that we're facing, for me, I'm starting to see that the relationship between government and business is starting to go in the right direction. And this is required because we have to deliver much-needed reforms in order to make sure we have growth. You've heard, I mean, warnings from Trevor as well, because without reforms and without growth, we're going to continue with a significant part of our population living in hopelessness. Navigating the turbulence of global geopolitics and economics is tough. We draw on our resilience daily, but we have the heart, the foundation, and the commitment to ensure that we come through on the other side stronger. I'm excited about the future of our company and our country. To color the marathon route that we are running, I thought it would be helpful to express how we're going to restore this iconic South African brand as a blue chip company that it is. We're committed to unlocking full value and building a more sustainable future Sasol. Our journey is guided by two strategic pillars. One, strengthening our foundation, and two, growth and transformation. Our short-term focus for this company has to be strengthening our foundation businesses. This is enhancing delivery from the business to maximize cash flow generation, which is super critical so that we can restore and strengthen our balance sheet. Key decisions have already been taken. I mean, in less than a year, we've already taken final investment decision on a coal destoning project. This project is going to allow us to start fixing the coal quality challenges which will help us to restore the Secunda or the South African value chain to its full potential. In international chemical business, we've also taken measures to reset this business to optimize value. I mean, as Alex was said, we've invested, $12 billion in our international business. We have to make sure that that business starts giving us the returns. And we're already making progress. I did indicate during my results that we're already expecting an uplift of our EBITDA between $100 and $200 million from where we ended last year. And we've taken decisive actions in that business as well. So we remain committed to a balanced and measured approach as well in transforming our business, ensuring ongoing value creation across all the stakeholder groups. Our growth and transformation ambition will see us build a new Sasol with sustainability at the core. We will not move too fast or too slow, but what we're going to do, we will transition our business in lockstep with our customers to continue to provide them with the products meeting their needs. Our priority is to reduce our carbon intensity as we transform our business to create new business opportunities and growth. This pragmatic approach to grow and transformation will allow us to deliver the needs of our multiple stakeholders. The Sasol shareholders, our employees, our customers, the environment, and the communities that we operate in. The road ahead for us is clearly laid out with opportunities and challenges. We have 75 years of legacy that has shaped who we are as a company. The history of corporate resilience is a testament to the strength, adaptability, innovative spirit of our people through the years. Regardless of the externalities, the shifts and volatility that we have experienced, it is our resilience and determination that we draw on to continue the marathon. As we look to the future, we will continue to learn the lessons, foster a culture of resilience, and navigate the uncertainties of tomorrow with confidence and strength. This will ensure that Sasol continues to be a cornerstone organization that delivers sustainable shareholder value while making a positive difference to the lives of our customers, people, and communities. So in conclusion, since we're in a land surrounded by mountains, so as I ran, I enjoyed the landscape, around the Hermanas. I want to close with a quote from Nelson Mandela. I'll paraphrase it. In his concluding chapter in his book, Long Walk to Freedom, Nelson Mandela said, when you scale a mountain and you reach the top, you realize there are many more mountains to climb. As the people of Sasol, we will successfully climb all the mountains ahead of us by navigating the challenges and harnessing the opportunities in this uncertain environment. Baya danki. Thank you. Ngiyabonga.
Thank you very much, Simon. Maybe I'm going to go back into the time that I was working in the corporate world, as I was telling a little story before lunch. And every time at ABSA that we would see investors, because ABSA was trying to get global investors, and you've got a listing on the New York Stock Exchange, so you have a lot of global investors already, they always asked about South Africa. 80% of the conversation was, what's going on in South Africa? And then finally, if you could satisfy them, 20% would be about what's happening at the company. I'm sure it's the same today. And how do you answer that question to those investors?
Thanks, Alec. I actually just returned from our roadshow because we released the results on the 23rd of Feb. And then we had to go and do an international roadshow, and you are spot on. That's what's top of the mind for investors. It's not about your company, but the environment where the company finds itself. So that question is the number one question from most of the international investors, both large and medium-sized institutional investors. My answer now, because I have to reply them with what I see now, I reply them with the fact that there is now hope, because being Sasol and what the role that Sasol plays, there's a lot of engagement with very, very senior government people. What we see now in the entire government, from the broad political spectrum, is that there's willingness to engage, to listen, and to co-create the solution that's required for the future. And for me, that's a good sign, and it's a momentum that all of us must capitalize on. Because if we lose that momentum, we have no one to blame in 2029 if we all get an outcome that we don't want. Because at the end of the day, the population in this country will vote in terms of how they feel and what's happening to them. So for me, this current set of government has a fantastic opportunity. So I hope we can do less talking and more action, because time is ticking. It's almost a year. I mean, one doesn't realize how quickly time goes.
So you are in the camp that the government of national unity must hold. Now, as Gayton said today, divorce is off the table, Ms. Zilla. That's not an option. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I just want to go back. I mean, Adrian this morning spoke about the mantle that must hold. And all of us, for me there, it's a functional government. It's a very, very active business where the business community comes in to contribute to the development of the country, and an active citizenry, where the people make sure that they contribute to democracy, because democracy is a funny system. It's not a system where you just vote and you wait for 5 years and vote again. The only way it works is that people must stand up and be counted, because the conditions will never be perfect. Conditions will never be perfect. So we can't wait for perfect conditions to do something. For me, the men and women that are going to make a difference are those that have a vision of what they want to have in the future. And they have to work very, very hard to make it a possibility. And that we owe it to the generations coming after us, because our time will pass and others will come after us. So when those people come, we have to have something that we show and give to them and hand over to them to take this country forward.
So nothing's perfect, but I'd love to get your thoughts of what the deputy president said today. When he left here, because I see there's a poll going around and a lot of the community say, oh, we don't believe this guy. Are you prepared to give him the benefit of the doubt?
I'm not an expert in politics, but when I listen to him almost being biased, I hear that there's a recognition of what needs to be done. The mistake that we're going to make, all of us, is to think that the work that must happen, the politicians must do it. I think if we start thinking like that, we're going to go nowhere in 5 years. What we must recognize is that everyone realizes something needs to be done. We just need to take action. If we need reforms, business must point out those reforms, create a scorecard, and we need to be vocal if these reforms are not happening. Because without proper structural reforms, you'll be unable to grow the economy. If you can't grow the economy, you go more into trouble. I don't think any of us must not accept that 50% of the young people in this country are unemployed. Just because you don't see something, it doesn't mean it's happening. We cannot accept that the majority of our people are living in poverty. We have to be, as business leaders, as community leaders, as concerned citizens, we have to build a country and a future that we want. So we have to act, and we have to be vocal, because without being vocal about what needs to happen, then you are not going to go anywhere.
Simon, there are, as I mentioned earlier, there are 20 young people who are here who've been given tickets by others who've sponsored them. But your story, how did you come to, first of all, excel academically sufficiently to get a bursary from SASL? Tell us a little bit about what you did, or maybe the influences that are on your life that you could pass on to younger people who would like to also be CEO of SASL one day.
Yeah, thank you. It's a deeply personal story, but you've asked it, so I will tell you. Because I remember it with a fond memory. So if you grow up in a rural community where no one in your family has been to university, where you're facing all these adversities, it's easy to give up. So I think when I look at myself, I was smart, but average, because you don't give it your all. But there's something that I call the power of one person, the individual. So my mother actually got married through an arranged marriage. So she had to quit Standard 5 at that time. When she was 17, she got married. My dad, his father was not there. So he grew up with his uncle. He had to leave and go to work since he was 13, 14. I think he was Standard 2. That's his highest education. So he worked in a garage. He worked as a domestic worker. Then when he was in a garage, he got a license. Then he worked as a driver. I mean, he learned how to drive and he got a driving license. And most of his life, he worked as a driver. I mean, until I finished. I remember very well, he used to earn 150 rands per week. And I mean, most of the money ends up in transport and food. So you're not going to think, ooh, I'm going to go to university. You don't have any of those dreams. But something extraordinary happened to me. So when I was in standard 3, which is grade 5, His employer, where he was working in Pretoria, Jan Hercules in Daspoort as a driver there. His employer asked him, I mean, I used to call him Bas Jan Hercules. He asked him, he says, what can I do for you? You're a loyal employee. He's never been sick. I mean, since I've known him, he's never ever taken sick leave until he finished. And I've never done the same as well. I'll copy him on that one. So he's never been sick. He always went to work and very, very committed employee. And his employee asked him, what can I do for you? And he says, no. As long as I work here, just buy my sons all the textbooks. So then he bought me all the textbooks. So I had all the textbooks. And that action completely changed my life and created a spirit of generosity in me. From one person, because now I had the textbooks, I knew the sacrifice that my dad was doing. He goes to work at 4 a.m. He came back at 8, 9. And then I've got these textbooks from his employer. I had to study them. And that is why in the village, everyone asked me, I used to have, a candle burning and always studied because of his sacrifice. And it was the least that I could do. And I didn't even worry. I mean, I remember people used to ask me, you clearly have no money. We see you are studying and what do you think this is going to end? And I didn't know. But I mean, when I was young as well, I mean, I came across the scripture where Moses opened the Red Sea. So it was impossible for me. I said, I don't know. But when the time is right, the God of the Red Sea will just bring the money. And the money did came at the end. So that's how I started. But for me, the key, it was the power. It was Jan Hercules. It's him buying me the textbook. It's a very, very small thing. But for me, it was a big thing. It meant the world to me. And it's something that I always encourage people. You must not think of doing big things. Just do small, right things. Because all those actions they have a multiplier effect. Because without what he did, I could have also been absorbed in the hopelessness and I could have become nothing.
That's an extraordinary story, and thank you for sharing it with us. Have you retained that love of reading?
Yeah, always. You always have to read. You always have to read.
What kind of books do you read?
I like leadership books. I like leadership books. I mean, cause you learn a lot. I mean, if you want to serve, you always have to learn. I mean, equip yourself. So I read a lot of, John Maxwell's work. I mean, now I'm busy reading. I read The Diary of a CEO. It was a fantastic book to read. That's something that I do. And now I'm reading a controversial book, but it's interesting. It's The False Alarm by Bjorn Lomborg. I mean, that talks about how to have a balanced approach to climate change. So it's a very interesting book. I'm busy with it. I'm not done, but yeah, up to so far, it's a very interesting book.
I heard him at ARC, and that was really a lovely segue to the next. Rob Herzog spent half an hour with him. He sat down with Bjorn, and he was very, very impressed by what he had to say. Just for those of you who haven't come across the book yet, it went along the theme of the climate change, I don't want to call it propaganda, but philosophy is actually bankrupting or impoverishing people in countries that are swallowing it, whereas the countries that are not swallowing it are continuing to grow and use the carbon emissions. And he uses the example, ARC used the example of the UK, which has 1% of the world's carbon emissions and is desperate to get it to 0.5%. Whereas last year, China went from 40 to 41, and it's still producing 2 new coal-fired power stations every week or every month or whatever it is. Now, that's a big segue for you, because here in South Africa, we have this obsession, as do the Germans and as do the Brits and as do no longer the Americans, but there was, and we all know there is climate change. There's no question about that. But if the world, Neil Ferguson, I think, gave the example that if you take the GDP of a country higher, then your emissions decline because people become more educated and then stop making logs or wooden logs in their homes. Just give us your thought on all of this, because it's critical to South Africa. It's critical to the debate globally and very, very important for Sasol.
Yeah, no, thank you. There's always reasons how the debate evolves and the positions that the countries take. I mean, Europe already, especially the Scandinavian countries, they already have a green grid. So the electricity is from hydro, wind and solar. So then Europe can take a very, very harsh stance, towards CO2 emissions. Then if you look at the U.S. and you go and study the U.S. energy system, you'll see that it's still fossil fuel based. I mean, some coal, lots of gas and some renewables. And the journey for them to transition, it's a tough journey. And South Africa is actually worse because you have a coal-based economy completely in terms of your electricity systems, which are coal-based. And it's a resource that you have. So your transition journey, even much harder. So for me, what I advocate for is a pragmatic approach, not to pour lots of emotions into it, but lots of facts and data. I mean, for all of us to understand, using the country as an example, to say if you say South Africa must be net zero in 2035 or 2040, what actually is required? Because once you see the exact plan of what's required, then you get to recognize that you don't have a plan. So for me, you must have a clear, pragmatic transition plan, what you need to build, how you're going to do it. And you must do that in a way that you protect the jobs, the communities, and the environment. You have to find that perfect balance, and different countries will have different approach. So when it comes to Sasol, we've got a global business. In internationally, we're on par with everyone. At home, our Secunda value chain, which is a fantastic value chain, because this value chain doesn't just burn coal. We actually take coal and build the whole value chain through it. And we make multiple products, not just, petrol and diesel. We make chemicals that are in everyday's life. We make ammonia, which goes into fertilizers. It goes into explosives. That goes into food. That goes into the mining industry. We make plastics. That goes into many, many industries. We've fully beneficiated the coal with this fantastic technology that came into the country in 1950, and we operated it and perfected it. Therefore, our transition has to be built on the foundation of what we have. So for me, it's not about, let's just quickly shut down. It's about how do we build something new on top of it. And you can see we're not waiting. I mean, when it comes to renewable energy, Sasol is already at 750 megawatts. I mean, there's no other corporate with that amount of green electrons. We already have it. I mean, 69, 70 megawatts of it is already flowing to the grid. 500 is under construction. We'll be building the largest wind farm in Southern Africa in the Jeffreys Bay area, 330 megawatts of wind. That's what we're doing. So through, partnerships, we're busy advancing the change. But that change has to be built on what we have, because our Secunda facility uses up to 1.5 gigawatts. So that gives us a fantastic foundation that we can bring green electrons to offset the energy that we're using from coal. And by so doing, we're having a pragmatic change, other than trying to shut down and then try to build again, because you can't fund the transition. The transition has to be self-funded. We have to make sure, and that's what we advocate for. I'm sure you've seen, even on the carbon tax, that there is discussion even via the whole of business, that the carbon tax money must start going back into the, not into the fiscals, but it must go into funding our own transition, because we must do it. We must do it at a pace that it works with the customers. In Sasolburg, we're the first company in Africa to produce green hydrogen. And when we did it, no one has bought it, because green hydrogen costs 7 to 8 times more than normal gray hydrogen or blue hydrogen. And once the hydrogen was produced, there was no single customer who was there to buy it. So we also have to make sure that as we transition and we do sustainable products, we do it in lockstep with the customers. So we've learned from that. It was a billion rand lesson, but it was a good lesson. We've went through that. We are busy now. You saw with biodiesel. Already we're working with Anglo American. We signed an MOU at the mining in Daba, so that we start already with the customer as we develop it and the pace that's required to make sure that both of us can reach the end goal.
But what happens if the Trump vision of the world, drill baby drill, starts being repeated elsewhere, that other countries, and we're seeing it in Europe, where they're saying, no, we'll put this net zero story elsewhere. Would you slow down your transitions?
Not necessarily. I think for us, how you must transition the company, it has to make economic sense. I don't think you can start and stop, start and stop. So for us, renewable energy right now, it's the way to go because it's much, much cheaper than, coal-based electricity. So if you need energy, you have to go renewable. Therefore, we'll continue doing that. Because when you're transitioning, as long as it's creating value for the shareholders, we'll do that. What we won't do is to go too far like we did with green hydrogen, where you spend money and you have a product that no one wants and you try and sell it. So for me, we have to be pragmatic. I don't think we should hold on. You just have to choose the best and the cheapest energy source. As the EVs, we're seeing a revolution in electric vehicles from China. As those cars come in, what it's going to do, it is going to change the dynamics in the market in terms of liquid fuels. And that by itself will then set a new path. So for me, as long as you're in lockstep with the market and the customers, you'll be able to make it. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to be pragmatic. We're not going to deny. I don't think any of us. It's our responsibility to make sure that we use resources efficiently and we protect the planet for the future generations. But how you do that, I think we have to move at a pace which is pragmatic, which is reasonable, and which everyone understands how that is going to be funded. Because you saw in terms of the country, there was the $8.5 billion that was pledged, and people are already starting to pull out of those pledges. Therefore, the country has to figure out a way by itself. How do we build the additional grid? How do we do reforms to enable people to come and invest in the country in an energy system that can save us money?
It's going to be such an interesting read, the book that you're on now, and to see if your thoughts change at all in that way. But before we go to the questions from the audience, can you give us some insight into the development of the oil and gas fields off South Africa's coasts and the fracking opportunity in the Karoo? And I say this because James Lorimer, who's the DA's shadow minister of mining, has done a lot of work on this and told a lot. In fact, he came with us to London in May, and he said this resource that South Africa has, the oil and gas fields off the coast, is as the potential to be as big a boom as diamonds and gold. Now, those were transitional for the country. You are our energy champion. Are you able to get involved there where foreigners like Total have pulled out?
Yeah, at the offset, I must say, the balance sheet required to do those developments is massive. So as Sasol, we will not take that risk, alone. But, in future, through partnerships, is something that, of course, will help to always evaluate. My view, if I look at the region, I think the region has to cooperate. I think countries in Southern Africa, you don't necessarily have to try and get your own resources. Because if you look at gas, Mozambique has more than 100 TCF of gas, which is similar or even more gas resources than Qatar has. Therefore, and we do have gas, but my view, if I do a quick assessment, that the gas in Mozambique will be easier to use and you can use it across the region. So I'll first start and step back and think about regional cooperation. You don't have to do and explore your own resources if you can find them in a neighboring country, because it creates a win-win situation across the whole region. So I hope that, the governments in the region will first think about it like that and say, how do we create an energy system throughout the region? The same way in terms of water, South Africa relies on Lesotho for water from the Lesotho Highlands. We can do the same on some molecules as well. As you well know, Sasol did bring gas from southern Mozambique for 20 years, and it was a win-win for South Africa and Mozambique. And those partnerships, in my view, they need to continue. Of course, a country will always want to exploit its own resources if it's got, but you must always go for the cheapest resources, because what you don't want to do is invest so much money and end up with stranded resources, then you're not going to develop properly. So I think for me, that's how we need to think about it. And then there must be partnership. If there's something that's also learned from the Lake Charles project, is that we have to do this thing through partnership. And that's how we're going to progress going forward.
There are a lot of questions. What is your opinion on BEE and how do you address it at Sasol?
BEE, I mean, I've been watching most of the comments coming in through the chat. So that's the beauty of being in the group. I think businesses, if you look at the imperative of where the country comes from, we all have to say, what role do we play to ensure that there's equality? But for me, the qualifier has to be on competency. It has to be on saving costs. Because if you're going to bring a small company and then it creates an issue for you in terms of there's a premium to it, that for me, I don't think any company or corporation should do that. However, there should also be a better approach. That's what I call a better approach. It doesn't have to be necessarily be designated on race, but it has to be designated on, I mean, if you look at the young people, you look at the demographics of the country, you always have to say, how do I create something that in the future, we don't have to reverse it again? Because for me, I'm not a fan of you do something now, then in 30 years from now, we must, oh, now we must do white economic empowerment because all the young white people were never given a chance. We need to give everyone a chance because if we do that, the numbers will take care of themselves. You just have to be conscious and say, we have a country, here's the demographics, how do we bring representative small companies? And if you do that, you bring companies across all racial groups, you make sure they're inclusive, then you'll start to have a transition. So all that we can do is to check if what I call our conscious biases, because if you are biased, you end up doing the same thing without realizing you're doing something wrong and you can justify it. We need to check and make sure that as leadership, we're building an equal and inclusive society. I mean, I'll tell you a story. When I was young, I mean, I went to, Sasol took me to an accelerated management program in Stellenbosch. And so when I saw the list and I realized it was only black people, I told them, I'm not going. I told my land manager, no, I'm not going. I mean, and he says, why? I said, in my view and a vision of the future that I have, the leadership of this company will not be black people. It will be both black and white, male and female. So if your program only has black people, first of all, I don't even trust it that you're serious about what you say. Because if you're serious about leadership development for an organization, you must make sure that it's inclusive. So however how we intervene, we have to make sure that it's inclusive, that all of us transform the economy so that all of us can have a shared goal and a vision and a purpose, and we all give it 100% so that it works for the people coming after us. Because we can't keep on going in the extremes, you understand? We have to come and stay in the middle and say, how do we create everything that works for all our people? So for me, that's my view.
Brandon Bardenhorst asks, how would you describe the current relationship between Sasol and Eskom and your engagement with Mr. Marakani?
We're engaging positively with everyone. I mean, not just with Eskom. I'm both public and private. We're engaging with Transnet as well. Because for us as Sasol, where you can make a positive difference to making sure that we move in the right direction, that step you must take. We've actually had, I mean, if I give an example with Transnet, on the ammonia line, which was impacting the ammonia out of our facilities, we engaged with Eskom, with Transnet, we collaborated, shared our expertise on the maintenance of the locos and brought lots of locomotives that were offline back online. And that has created a win-win situation for both companies. We're busy engaging with Eskom because there is natural gas in Mozambique is finished. I mean, I've said it before that there's no gas in the south of Mozambique for the customers. The country needs to bring LNG. And the anchor for LNG is always gas to power. And for me, Eskom is well-suited in order to do gas to power. We are well-suited in helping and aggregating and bringing the gas. So there's a normal strategic partnership that we can do something that's commercially viable but makes sense for all the countries. So we will always be looking out for partnerships. You'll see, hopefully, by CMD or even before CMD, we'll be even announcing more partnership with other companies as well, because we believe that the only way to go forward is to make sure that there's proper partnership that helps the businesses, but it also helps us to make a positive change. I mean, you remember Adrian did talk about lots of companies contributing resources to NICOM when we had a crisis, and Sasol did put there most of our engineering expertise. We also put our expertise there and contributed lots of people to help business to make sure that we all went out of that situation that the country was facing. So I firmly believe in partnerships with both public and private companies, as long as the terms of engagement is clear and the goal is clear to everyone what we're trying to achieve.
Our community member from Cyprus says the Sasol share price has been depressed for a long time. As an overseas investor, what share price can we expect in the next 3 years?
I wish I had that crystal ball, but I can only tell him to buy more shares, because if you look at, all the valuations and multiples, the company is, it's severely, undervalued. And of course, the balance sheet, that's a concern for investors, and we're working very, very hard to repair that balance sheet. The underlying performance, of the global businesses, not only international chemicals, because that business, of course, that was our most pressing concern. We're busy, taking interventions to fix that, and we'll show the results that at the year end. At home, the coal quality was an issue holding back the business. The business is still generating cash, but it was holding it back. So we also have taken decisions. And it will take, you will see, we said from H1 this year, before December this year, that project is finished. And you also start to see the uptick there. There was, of course, a concern on carbon tax, and will the company, be closed down in 2030 because of the legislation that was penning out. I'm not sure if you read, the section on carbon tax in the budget. You can see that, there is already a regime that we can work with, that the allowances have been retained up to 2030. The ability of offsets has been increased. And finally, there's already a talk of a recycle and a rebate. So for me, that legislative environment is also looking very, very positive. And the government has given up to 2030, and will continue working with them so that we have clarity up to 2040. So if I look at this critical South African business, I'm confident that we're restoring it to its former glory. And therefore, if the share price reflects the truth, it will once all of these things come through.
That's so interesting. When you get these big mega shifts in approach around the world, like Bjorn's book, which I'm sure is going to help even more. Mm. It has a direct impact on a company like yours, and yet investors don't seem to be absorbing it yet. Haven't you been telling them enough, or is the budget just too fresh?
No, we are. We're talking to everyone. I think where we are now, for me, and I always remind all the Sasol people, is just get your head down and deliver the results. And the investors, they will follow. They'll see your results. I think the legislation is too complex that people go and study and then they'll make up their minds. But at least for me, from where I sit, not because of Trump, but I think this country is just waking up to the reality of how our transition is likely going to look like. Because all of us used to say, we must build by 2030, 14,000 kilometers of grid line. Then you look at what we've done over the last 3 years. Even if we build less than 1,000. So you see the undertaking that's required to do something like that. And the cost, to put a grid of that magnitude, you're probably looking at $150 to $200 billion, not rents. So if you look at the cost required, the infrastructure required, even going to those countries to book for the lines, then everyone's going to be realistic. The issue is that it starts with emotions. Then after the emotions is the realism that says, okay, what are we exactly going to do? How do we break that into 5 years, 10 years, 15 years? And how do you then measure that we're on track? And once you look at all of that, then you are likely to moderate your expectation, but you have to push on with the work that needs to be done. So I think a balanced narrative will emerge in the world. And I advise and strongly advise that we never abandon the transition, but we do it in the most cost-effective and economical way to preserve the jobs, to preserve the companies, and to preserve the environment as well.
Jonah Katz, here's an interesting question. As a 16-year-old, 16-year-old, listening, regarding the decrease in the Sasol share price, what are the main reasons for the drop, and what is Sasol doing to bring the price of the stock back up? Additionally, what is the expected timeline for the increase in the share price? You're being put on the spot here with these shares.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the market is the market. I mean, the market responds to performance, and we focus on that. So I'm not going to give a timeline. I think there's equity investors that are good at these things, and they analyze, and I mean, their advice is much better than mine. But for me, I'll summarize it in two, because you can plot our share price and then you can see what happened, because you can put the major events that has driven the company to where it is today. When it's a fantastic project, the Lake Charles project. It's fantastic. I mean, if you go and see that plant now, I mean, it's extraordinary that we can do something like that. And we did it. We built it in very, very difficult conditions. But it was just way too expensive. And I mean, and that is still hanging on our balance sheet, and we need to deal with it. And we are taking decisive actions to deal with it. And so I'm pleased to in terms of the outlook that we have for the company, that we will repair that balance sheet. We've given ourselves, I mean, a timeline. We've changed our dividend policy to also allow us to do that, so that we can always pay dividends when we have cash, but we need to prioritize dealing with that balance sheet. So that for me is a big factor. Then you had the environmental uncertainty that was emerging in the world. I mean, in Southern Africa, we are, I mean, a coal-based company. We have lots of gas coming from Mozambique, but coal is the resource that we use. And I mean, when you think about, I mean, the fossil fuel, coal is the most hated. Coal, I mean, then oil, then gas. But I think that the sentiment is correctly being moderated, so that there's realism in that. And we're not standing still, like I said. We're busy making sure that we focus on the carbon intensity and deal with it. And over the last 4 years, the performance of the South African business, even though it's at 90%, 90 is not 100. So that was also an overhang on the share price, and we're also addressing that. So we know the key reasons that was driving, I mean, the share price, and we are making sure that we put our effort in making sure that we can address that decisively. And Team Sasol, all 29,000 of us are focused on this fact to make sure we restore the company to a blue chip stock that it is.
The last question, and it's a specific one from Ryan Shane. How seriously is Sasol considering the Lake Charles IPO idea that you've previously mentioned? Are there any updates?
Yeah, we are very serious. However, I mean, if you read the article is actually very interesting, because it says Sasol is muting an IPO. And yeah, of course, we're thinking about options, but we have to restore the cash flows from that business, and we're busy with it, because you will not be able to go to your market and list an entity that doesn't have solid and very strong cash flows. We're busy with that work. I think, I mean, according to our estimation, 24 to 36 months, we will be done. We have to see what happens. Then we have to look at all options, because listing might not be the only option. You can partner with someone for a while and list. You can list directly, but you have to restore the EBITDA and the cash flows, because it's those cash flows that determine the valuation and the potential upside that you can get and the value that you can unlock for shareholders. So we're serious about it. And the reason for it is that a coal-based entity and a chemicals entity don't have the same multiples and valuation. So there is lots of value that's locked, where we can unlock multiples by listing it. So that work will continue. And when the time is right, we're going to do it.
I'm sure there are investors sitting back and thinking, I don't mind taking a long-term view, because if that is the plan into the future, once you've got it right, who knows? You could be like Pick and Pay and Boxer. Nothing wrong with that. Thank you very much, Simon Baloyi.
Yeah, Alec, thank you so much.
Right now, you can get the cheapest Forex rate around, right here, on Shift. Pay less for your dollars, pounds, and euros here, and get to shop more here, and do more here, and enjoy more ooh-la-la here. Shift also lets you trade and transfer currencies, and buy shares in the world's best companies. It all happens right here, on Shift. You won't find a cheaper Forex rate anywhere else, no matter where you bank. Download the Shift app today.
In the world of business banking, projections, numbers, and your bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. That's why we understand that running a successful business takes endurance, drive, and partners who are willing to walk the journey with you. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary.
Downings is South Africa's leading marquee infrastructure company, proudly celebrating 25 years of excellence, renowned for creativity, innovation, and unmatched technical expertise. Our event marquees and semi-permanent structures elevate any project with style and sophistication. Whether it's a corporate event or a commercial project, we tailor every structure to meet your needs with world-class precision. Visit downings.co.za to consult with our expert team. Downings, your trusted marquee specialists nationwide.